always stay connected with 99.9% reliable Sky broadband. Switch your home to Sky broadband today. See sky.ie for more.
It's Wednesday, July the 27th, and you are very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan, returned from an unexpectedly lengthy absence, during which our political editor, Pat Lee, graciously and gracefully and elegantly at times, took the chair. Thanks for that, Pat.
What hope?
Also here today are Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones. Good to see you guys.
Great to see you again, Hugh.
Good to see you, Hugh. Welcome back.
I have lots to ask about. I've been listening with interest over the last while I've been away. But also, this is a kind of a end of term feel this week, Jen. The cabinet is meeting as we speak.
That's right, yeah. This is the last cabinet meeting of the summer. They hope, they think, they expect. You just never really know, do you? But yeah, there are 50 items on the agenda today. So we kind of expected it would be jam-packed, and it is. There's a couple of big ticket things up there. Obviously, there will be an update on Ukraine and the situation in relation to accommodating Ukrainian refugees. There's plans from Helen McEntee to change the laws around consent, which we covered a bit on our front page today. But the big thing today, I think the big story politically, is the lack of agreement on the climate targets and those sectoral ceilings. Looked last night like there wouldn't be an agreement today, sort of more optimistic noises being sounded, but we just don't know yet. But yes, this is the last cabinet, unless they hold, of course, an incorporeal cabinet later on in the week or maybe later on today to agree those targets.
There's a bit of hardball being played, Pat. Our lead story on the front of this morning's newspaper quotes Oisin Coughlin, who's a significant figure in the Irish environmentalist movement, Friends of the Earth. And he's sort of saying this is one the Greens could walk on. Isn't that what he says?
That's more or less what he says. Yeah, they issued a statement last night in which the Friends of the Earth raised the prospect. I mean, they didn't issue a threat. And, you know, obviously they're not in a position to issue threats on behalf of the Green Party. But it was certainly raising the prospect that, this could lead to a serious rift, perhaps an existential rift in the coalition. I think that's right. I've been writing about this for some time now because I think you can't overestimate the importance of this to the Green Party. This is the reason it is to, you know, achieve meaningful climate action, and that is measured in these targets and in the subsequent plans to achieve the targets, which targets are now set in law. Let us not forget, because of the Climate Act of last year. And I think this goes, as I say, this goes to the very heart of the reason why the Greens are in government. The bargain that they made, not just with Fianna Fáil, but the bargain that the Greens made with themselves, that they would go into government to achieve this. And if they find that the extent to which they can achieve this is not near where they had hoped, doesn't match the sort of ambition that they had when they went in, then I think that puts very serious question marks over the survival of the government. As you'll know, I'm not somebody who calls a crisis in the government every week for the sake of a headline, but I think this is a really, really big issue for the government. And I think if it cannot be resolved to the satisfaction of all sides, both the Greens and also Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and just as the Greens have the Friends of the Earth and other groups in the background that they have to keep on side, so Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have their own backbenchers and farmers and farming organisations that they have to keep on side. And I think that if they cannot find a compromise that is acceptable to all sides, then I think it is really serious for the survival of the government.
And how hard is that compromise to achieve? This, lots of talk about the difference between the 22% and the 30% contribution. Where might a compromise fall? You know, am I just randomly going to stick a pin somewhere between those and say, if they get to 27, the Greens can live with it, or if it's under 25, they're gone? Or do we know? Do we know where they're pitching their tents?
I mean, on one level, you would say, okay, so the discussion is between 22 and 30. So as you say, stick a pin in the middle and that's your compromise. I don't think it's as simple as that, because if it were as simple as that, it would have been done by now. It's how you get to somewhere in the middle distance. I don't think it's going to be 22%, and I don't think it's going to be 30%. Where it lands, if there is to be a deal, will depend on a couple of things. And, you know, everybody you talk to inside and outside government about this stresses the complexity of it. Because, so one of the arguments, for example, right, one of the arguments that's going on at the moment is about the role of mitigation. So let's say, you know, you're a farmer and you decide you can stick a load of solar panels on your farm. Okay, but that mitigation goes into the energy pot or the electricity generation pot, if you like, as production of renewables. And therefore, that is counted under the heading of electricity generation. What the farmers are saying, with some justification, I think, what the farmers are saying is that if this is done by farmers on their land, then it should count in the agriculture pot. But what the Greens are saying, well, then if that is counted in the agriculture pot, then show us how you can get more generation of renewables for electricity, because simply moving, you know, let's say 5% or whatever from the electricity generation pot to the agriculture pot doesn't lower your overall emissions. All it does is get agriculture off the hook. So those are the type of discussions that are going on at the moment. There is a view in some parts of the government, more so on the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael side, that the Greens will just have to take what they can get as a very important staging point and, you know, try to improve the performance over the remaining 7 or 8 years as better technologies come on stream. The view in the Greens is that this is what everybody signed up to. This is the reason they're in government. They have to get something meaningful and deliverable at this stage that doesn't let agriculture off the hook, because already the relatively low levels of emissions cuts in agriculture, between whether it is 22 or whether it's 30%, mean that the other sectors such as industry and electricity generation we've already referred to and transport, that those cuts have to be enormous. And what some people are warning about on the Green side is that if you let agriculture off the hook at 22 or 24%, that means that the targets you will need to reach in the other sectors, such as transport, will be incredibly large. That is to say, they won't have any credibility because they are too large. So it's a highly complex and delicate negotiation that is going on. I'm not sure, to be honest, that there is a landing ground possible that keeps everybody happy. I guess we will have to wait for the coming days to see whether that is achievable.
Jack, Pat has made the point in the podcast several times over the last couple of years that, you know, the Greens have achieved a lot in terms of the targets that were set. This is why the Greens are in government. It seems relatively clear to me that they can't do what Pat was talking about there. They can't wait and see. They can't accept a compromise which is below their kind of baseline figures. Because the reality is, isn't it, that these extremely difficult to achieve targets, we're already behind the curve on them. I think emissions went up this year rather than down, didn't they? So not heading in the right direction already. And the idea of waiting for another 2 or 3 years for the gravity of the situation to impress itself on the partners in government, it's just not going to happen, isn't there? There is a point at which walking is better than staying.
Yeah, and I think that's why we've seen as of this morning, Wednesday morning, a kind of ratcheting up of the rhetoric from the Green side. They had been comparatively quiet when you look at them against the fairly outred comments from the Fine Gael side in particular, who probably feel more vulnerable to their farming vote being eaten away from under them than Fianna Fáil, which might explain why they've been that bit more vocal on it. But the Greens have kind of more or less kept their counsel, at least in a public sense. But this morning we see Pauline O'Reilly, the chair of the Greens, doing an interview on the Claire Byrne show, discussing how 22 and 23% won't cut it. And to my knowledge, that's the first time someone in the Greens has publicly been talking about, you know, numbers not being good enough. So I think that, you know, they at this point feel that they have to start negotiating on the airways and trying to kind of reduce the room for manoeuvre for the other two parties to effectively kind of engineer an extension on this. And I think it's more Fine Gael who are pushing for the extension and for a pause than Fianna Fáil. And I think that the point that you make is correct, Hugh, that, like, you know, now is the time for action, or certainly all the science would suggest that now is the time for action, and that informs the Greens' negotiating stance. Against that, I suppose you would have to you'd have to make the assessment that, like, does taking action now versus in September make a difference? And, like, from a kind of mechanical point of view, you know, like, will there be grossly more emissions issued over that kind of month period? No. And, like, it doesn't make a difference in terms of, like, the effectiveness of the climate action plan. So you can kind of see the political rationale for taking a step back and allowing for what one source last night called de-escalation. But I think that there's a risk in that hiatus, which hasn't been acknowledged by the people who are advocating for it, which is that if they step back from it, it becomes the story of August almost by default. And there's a real danger in being the story of August, because it means that, like, all the kind of free-floating political and media attention amongst those journalists that are still working during August is focused in on you and narrowly focused in on this one issue. And if that one issue is climate, certainly talking to people across the coalition yesterday, there was a sense that, you know, this will be a damaging and divisive period, which will only lead to increased acrimony and lead to, you know, multiple instances of farmers or farming groups shouting across the airwaves at, you know, climatologists and environmentalists and Green Party reps, and that will be damaging in and of itself to the political cohesion, not only of the government, but of the wider kind of political system and the kind of discussion around this. And I think that it risks, I think that a further delay probably risks accentuating something that, you know, this debate and to a lesser extent the turf debate has already indicated, which is the emergence of climate as a real hinge point and a real dividing line in Irish politics, and something that is going to become a kind of an organising point for people, you know, with how they identify in climate politics, what they believe, what they think needs to be done, and who needs to do it, I think is going to be an important thing in Irish climate, in Irish politics, not just in Irish climate politics going forward. So, you know, my point overall, I suppose, is that if you give the gap for that to kind of metastasize into, it can become more and more damaging and more and more divisive, and potentially increase the chances that, you know, it could be a fatal incident for the government. Not to mention increase the chances that if you're negotiating this around September, not only are you bringing yourself closer to the budget, you're bringing yourself closer to the ploughing championships, which is like the alpha and omega of rural Ireland. So, you know, the idea that, you know, some sort of deal that wouldn't be popular in rural Ireland is signed off in and around the ploughing championships, one person was observing to me yesterday, could just prove this kind of massive rallying point.
So how big a problem is this for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, Jen? I mean, Jack points to Fine Gael in particular, but I think it's, you know, there are significant figures in Fianna Fáil too. I mean, do they risk losing members of the parliamentary party over this if they're unhappy with it? Or is it the more long-term fear that the direction of that the polls have been going in for the last while will continue downwards for them and it'll be a disaster for them, this policy, at the next election?
Yeah, certainly I think the narrative perhaps last week was definitely that some of those backbenchers could have gone overboard. I think there's been kind of a change in language a little bit over the last couple of days. So over the weekend, there were a bunch of Fine Gael backbenchers, for example. They criticised what they said were the scapegoating of farmers. And I think amongst that group were TDs like John Paul Phelan, David Stanton, Charlie Flanagan, Paul Keogh, and then a number of senators like Garrett Ahern and I think John Cummins. And they kind of talked about this false narrative around agriculture. And there was very kind of strong noises coming from that contingent. But then it appears now yesterday and today and this morning that some of those backbenchers would actually favour a compromise, that they would be happy enough with something that was in the range of 24% to 26% in terms of agriculture. And I think obviously they must have been, and they would have been, consulting with various different farming organisations as they came to that position. And I think even if you look at what Barry Cowan has been saying, you know, he's now calling for a stakeholder forum that would monitor initiatives to reduce agriculture emissions, I think, over the next 2 years or so. And that's kind of more longer term call, I suppose. So I definitely think that language has softened a little bit in terms of those hardline backbenchers. I think one party that has found itself also in a tricky position is Sinn Féin, because they have refused to specify exactly what percentage emissions reduction they would support in the agriculture sector. It was really interesting to hear their environment spokesman, Darren O'Rourke, on the radio, and he talked about how this was a matter for government. I think he said they couldn't pluck, I think the words were, pluck a figure out of thin air. Now, one of the charges that Leo Varadkar, I think it was, made in the Dáil just before, actually it was just after that motion of no confidence, the charge that he made against Sinn Féin effectively was that what the party does is they go whichever way the wind goes. Actually, it was Heather Humphreys now you think about it. And this is something that if you go online now today or last night, you'll see all the Fine Gaelers and Fianna Fáilers using this line to kind of beat Sinn Féin across the head with and say, you know, Sinn Féin are weak on climate action and climate promises. And if they were in government, they wouldn't take the necessary actions that are needed for the essential survival of the planet. And I think the party definitely has found itself in a tricky spot there by not being able to specify what action it would take and by saying effectively that it would wait to see what the government decides to do because it's a matter for government.
Although, Pat, I'm not sure historically how much opposition parties have suffered from just attacking the government without putting forward clear policies of their own. In the history of Irish politics, maybe you could enlighten us on that.
No, attacking the opposition is good fun for the government, but I'm not sure it necessarily gets them anywhere. I mean, you could argue, of course, that when it comes to an election, what matters for an opposition party is not so much is not only how unpopular the government is, but what sort of plans that they can put before the electorate for a viable and different government. And I think we're some bit away from that yet. Particularly Sinn Féin is a whole heap of distance away from doing that on climate. On the other hand, you know, repeated surveys show that climate and climate action is not one of the topics that people tend to rate as most important in how they're going to vote. And this is one of the political difficulties for the government because, and I think people in government are beginning to wake up and realise this, that when these targets, and remember, we're still at the level of targets, there's a 51% target that it, by 2030 that is set in law. The process that is being undergone at the moment is the process of allocating how that target will be reached sector by sector, so by agriculture, transport, electricity generation, and so forth. What we haven't got to yet is the sort of measures that will be required to achieve those targets in the individual sectors. So, for instance, if, you know, there's the we know that part of the transport targets is to have 1 million electric vehicles on the road by 2030. That will mean that sometime in the middle of the decade, every single new car that is sold is going to have to be an electric car. Now, how do you, even assuming that the supply of electric vehicles is there, which is a pretty big assumption that would be at the very least challengeable. How do you persuade people to do it? Well, you've got to use things like the tax system. So how do you, how do you like having your new petrol or diesel car, having the road tax on it hiked fourfold and so forth? Like, these are going to be very difficult measures for any government, no matter who makes it up, to introduce, as long as the public don't rate climate as one of the top issues that they want to see a government deal with. And survey after survey tells us at the moment that they don't. Now, of course, that is going to change. And the argument that the Greens and the broader environmental lobby may make justifiably is, look around you, look at the effects of climate change, look at the worsening projections for global warming in the future, look at what that does to the livability of parts of the planet. Last week, it was 40 degrees in London. Okay, it was 30 here, but anyone who's experienced the difference between 30 degrees and 40 degrees, you know, knows how different an environment 40 is from 30. And, you know, all those sort of things that are happening, they're saying, you know, we have to act now. We have to act 10 years ago, but that's not an option. So we have to act now. But still, this doesn't appear to have made the breakthrough through to lots of voters. And, you know, I think it's going to be an extremely difficult political project for any government to implement over the coming years. And it wouldn't surprise me if it causes not just this government at some stage, you know, to fall apart, but governments in the future to fall apart as they are faced with the inevitability of the imperative to do things which will be very unpopular with lots of voters. Jean-Claude Juncker said at the height of the financial crisis that the dilemma for politicians was that they all knew what to do. They just didn't know how to get re-elected afterwards. And I suspect something similar will occur to politicians in the future as they deal with global warming and climate action.
Well, indeed, and as Jack said already, it's hardly surprising that this huge, arguably the greatest challenge of this century, of this generation, and probably the next couple of generations, hardly surprising that it starts becoming a very fraught political issue, because these are difficult problems and they're going to require difficult solutions. Anyway, we'll undoubtedly be talking about that again over the next few weeks. We will take a break now. We'll be back after this.
Never suffer the buffer again. Always stay connected with 99.9% reliable Sky broadband. Whether you're streaming on the sofa, gaming in the bedroom, or swiping in the bathroom. I said swiping. You'll never be without it. Switch your home to 99.9% reliable Sky broadband. Availability subject to location. Requires Sky Broadband Ultrafast. For more info, see sky.ie/speeds. 99.9% reliability based on time our broadband network works across our base.
And welcome back. Jen, I was listening to the podcast while I was away. There were certain things that were new and we might touch on them. What's happening in Britain was particularly interesting around Downing Street. But certain things seems we always have with us. The polls are bad for the government parties. Sinn Féin continues to be on the rise. And again, the old question over the last few weeks I was listening, that existential angst in Fianna Fáil, what's the party for? Where is it going? What's it all about? That never seems to go away, does it? I wonder, is it being prompted further now by the fact that the end of Micheál Martin's Taoiseachship is looming into view?
Taoiseachship, yes. Plus Assange. I mean, yeah, you're right. Some things are just perennials in politics, isn't it? And, you know, who and what is Fianna Fáil is just one guaranteed topic of conversation at least once a month, 12 times a year. But I think, you know, I was looking back on this term of government for this podcast, kind of just looking back on how it started and how it's ended. And it really is just two different tales, really, because how it started was on this incredible high, because just when the Dáil came back in mid to late January, that was when all of the COVID restrictions were lifted. And if you remember, like, I think sometimes we forget like how horrendous it was. Maybe, you know, we've forgotten because our brain is just doing us a favor of not remembering the pain of it. But, you know, like 8 p.m. curfews, hospitality passes, the impact on businesses, the loss of life, all that stuff we talked about many times. At the end of January, the great news was everything's being lifted. It's all going. And I think the national mood was quite buoyant. I definitely picked up on that within government. There was this feeling of this release of tension, this kind of much more kind of happy atmosphere. They finally got to announce some good news. And even at the time, they were talking about all the new bank holidays. They were going to bring in new public holidays. And the end of January was a good time. Fast forward to the end of term, and I'm sure we'll cover kind of what happened in between there. We've had, obviously, the biggest event during that time has been Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And that's had a number of different impacts, not least, obviously, the humanitarian impact. But in terms of Irish politics, firstly, the challenges accommodating Ukrainian refugees and the fact that the state ran out of space 2 weeks ago, which is a very serious, important development. And secondly, the impact on not only energy prices, but inflation generally, because that impacts on everything else, whether it's food, every other bill that basically lands on your doorstep. And that, in turn, has had a really big impact on national politics, as you would expect, because when you look at the poll that we had a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, it showed that the cost of living is one of the biggest issues that are facing voters. You know, Fianna Fáil dropped by 3 points to 20%. Same for Fine Gael, they were at a historic low. And the biggest winner, of course, was Sinn Féin. They grew by 3 points to 36%, which was their highest level in the series. And Mary Lou McDonald kind of seeing her approval rating up. And all of that is directly attributable to people feeling that they don't have the help that they need to deal with the cost of living crisis, which is directly a result of many different factors. You could go all the way back to Brexit, but most notably, obviously, the war in Ukraine. And I think the story from the start of term versus the story that they have gone into the summer recess with is totally different. And we said this actually on the last podcast. I genuinely can't see it getting any better for them.
No, it's going to get worse, Jack, isn't it? I mean, it's this new post-COVID environment we're in, and many of those challenges which Jen mentions are not peculiar to Ireland, particularly the cost of living crisis and potential problems with energy during the upcoming winter. But it's a kind of a tough task ahead now, isn't it? As we go into the autumn.
Yes, Hugh. If we look at where we are at the moment, we may merely be in the foothills of a rather large and hazardous mountain range that spreads out in front of the government over the autumn and winter. And I think that Jen is right in identifying the cost of living pressures as the most acute issue that they'll face, and the pressure that will come on them to backstop, I think, both households, which they've been doing to a large extent already this year, but probably also businesses, I would think, coming through into winter. And one of the things that the cabinet is looking at today is a low-cost loan scheme that would take advantage of relaxed kind of EU state aid rules for particularly energy-thirsty companies. So I think that, you know, there's perhaps this kind of, to a certain extent, a return of you know, this doctrine that we saw during COVID, that, like, you know, the state can and will and should backstop society when it's met with fundamental challenges. And we see that with the kind of with the supports that are being offered to households and being constructed for businesses. But I think that there's a ceiling on that didn't exist beforehand. And you see that when you read the summer economic statement that came out in the last 2 or 3 weeks. They talk more about there being very difficult choices ahead and the government not necessarily shying away from them. Which is an impressive rhetorical commitment to make, but at the same time, they're blowing through some of the expenditure rules that they set for themselves in terms of how much the Exchequer is willing to spend. They set these rules last year during the budget process, and they're already deciding to put them aside this year. So, you know, whether the government is able to actually respond to those new constraints that it articulates that it's perceiving is one thing that remains to be seen. And, you know, the broader financing environment is changing. You know, the macroeconomic and the central bank and the monetary policies that are flowing from Frankfurt are changing. So, you know, I don't think that it's going to be as easy for the government to kind of do that broad backstop role. And perhaps, you know, politically, neither should they be so eager to do so. So they enter into this very hazardous and pressured period that's going to stretch out initially across autumn and winter, but, you know, we should be expecting to live with higher gas prices, all the analysis would suggest, for a period of many months after that. In a more constrained environment and arguably with fewer tools with which to confront it. So it is a particularly politically hazardous time ahead, no doubt about that.
Is there a distinction, Pat, between the sort of the one-off temporary supports, which we've already seen for people's household energy bills and things like that, and a different way of reacting to inflation, which might contribute to inflation becoming endemic, I suppose. In other words, if you get pay rises, substantial pay rises, they're going to be there forever. Whereas if you give somebody 500 quid to pay their electricity bill during the winter, that is a one-off payment. Is there any consideration of the two different approaches to supporting people through the cost of living crisis?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And you'll see this in the structure of the budget when it arrives at the end of September. And we know a fair bit about this already through our reporting in recent weeks. So you will have increases in public spending of record magnitudes across many areas. We know that the budget is going to be, nearly 7 billion, 6.7 billion in terms of the annual spending increases that are agreed. That will include some elements of a new public sector pay deal, if there is one. That new spending will have to be paid for next year as well. It goes into the base, as the jargon goes. But there will also be a budget day package of in-year measures, and I think that is going to be very substantial indeed. And talking to some people in and around government, I mean, you hear estimates from 1 to 2 billion, perhaps beyond, of one-off giveaways, such as the type that we've seen to help people with fuel bills in the first half of the year. I think there will be a very substantial reprise of that on budget day. And they will be paid immediately or almost immediately, so that they're in this year's budget. And they will be financed largely by this extraordinary boom in corporation tax receipts that the government has experienced this year and expects to continue in the second half of the year. But as 10,000 economists have already warned the government, that those revenues are undependable. So what the government is trying to do is, I think, trying to be clever about it, answer the cost of living pressures with one-off in-year giveaways, and then we'll see what happens next year. I think, to reiterate what the guys have already said, I think when you look forward to the autumn, you can only see a very difficult political landscape for the government. It's got to agree a budget that will make, as we've discussed, some mitigations on the cost of living. But it's not going to, no matter what the government can realistically do, it's not going to eliminate the pressure on households. And you're going to see that pressure in rising fuel costs, in rising food costs, in rising rents. And now that the ECB is beginning to rise rates in the rising cost of mortgages. At the same time, the government will be dealing with external political issues such as the Northern Ireland Protocol, with policy difficulties within itself, as we've already discussed, on climate action, and the prospect, while all this is happening, that it's got to prepare for the changeover in the Taoiseach's office, which is a manoeuvre that has never been previously attempted by an Irish government, and will involve, I think, a lot more than simply, the two men at the head of the government changing office. I think that with that comes a whole heap of political pressures, the sort of questions about governments at its midterm, how does it reinvent itself for the second half of its existence, and how do the individual political and potentially electoral needs of the different components of the government, particularly as between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, how do they stack up and how do they interact with one another in the second half of the government, all of which is a very long-winded way of saying there's an interesting autumn ahead.
Well, and all of which also makes me feel, Jen, listening to all of that, that this government is perhaps a bit less stable than we thought it would be maybe a year or so ago. There was a general assumption that had a relatively comfortable majority, that it would, go the full term or close to the full term, barring catastrophes. But a number of things that we, a few TDs have been lost along the way over the last year or so. There's this current quite serious argument. There's those challenges ahead. And as Pat says, then there's the whole Taoiseach switcheroo upcoming too, which is potentially destabilizing for the parties involved. If you were a bookie, would your odds on the chances of this government surviving the full term, would they have changed over the last 2 months while I've been away?
Well, I am not a gambling woman because I already have too many other vices and I simply can't add another one to the list. But I think if you were a bookie, you probably wouldn't actually bank on them going all the way. But I actually think they probably will. I think that obviously there's a couple of things that happened in this term of the Dáil which were impactful. So the first thing was obviously the debate around the National Maternity Hospital, the relocation from Holles Street to St. Vincent's. And obviously two Green TDs went overboard. They didn't agree with the decision. It was all about having a hospital on state-owned land. And then it came into this big argument. Is a lease ownership, blah, blah, blah. We've been there. We've been through it. But, you know, they went overboard. They were out of the parliamentary party for 6 months. So they're currently outside of the umbrella. And then, of course, what happened secondly was obviously the debate around MICA and the crumbling blocks and homes in Donegal and other counties. Absolutely nightmare situation for the homeowners, but also a monumental headache for the government trying to figure out how to provide as much support to the homeowners as possible while still limiting kind of that exposure for the taxpayer. And in long story short, Joe McHugh obviously found himself in a position where he said he couldn't vote with the government. He voted against the government in terms of their passing their enhanced MICA legislation. So, that you know, obviously the numbers have been impacted by that. I don't think they would have liked to have found themselves in the position they did, which was losing their majority on paper halfway, not even halfway through, nearly halfway through the term of this government. Having said that, we, you know, it is also a fact that the government can rely on and does rely on the support of a number of independents. But of course, you know, independents may have found it easy to vote with the government on this occasion. There may be occasions in the future in which they find it much more difficult, such as in the event of, you know, we talked about this, I think, a couple of podcasts ago, if there are any blackouts this winter. If the lights go out in the winter, it'll be a really, really serious issue for the government. Now, they say they don't expect it, but as we know in politics too, you should expect the unexpected. So obviously that's a situation they wouldn't want to find themselves in. Those Green TDs will come back into the umbrella. But if this is kind of the scale of what they're facing at this point, and you have to remember, like, the biggest challenge they had when they formed the government was actually the coronavirus and COVID and about getting the country back to work and reopening the economy. Things have really changed. You know, we're talking about war and energy blackouts and obviously the climate aspect, which we talked about earlier on, which are much more politically sensitive individually for those parties, is what I'm saying. So, you know, it's hard to know, but my money would be on it going all the way. But I think the changeover itself will be tricky. I mean, I was talking to someone in government yesterday, like, now that the big issues are kind of not out of the way, but now the summer settled, people are starting to go back to gossiping and speculating, and people are kind of saying, right, what's going on with the changeover and who's going to be dropped? And I was talking to someone yesterday who was trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with Stephen Donnelly, like, will he stay? Will Micheál Martin want to keep him in? And even though people are saying, when Leo Varadkar goes to make his calls, you know, for the cabinet, will the first people who he calls be the people who are getting sacked? So if you're the first person getting the call and you're a minister, are you going to go, oh no, I'm clearly getting sacked? So this is the conversation now over the summer has moved on to that. And that will be politically tricky on a number of different fronts. So we'll just have to really wait and see, Hugh.
Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree with Jen, actually. Like, I think that there is every chance this government goes the term. And I think that if you were looking for signs of encouragement, Jen has identified a couple of really good ones there, the National Maternity Hospital and MICA, which are both examples of, you know, something that is the essence of government, really, which is getting big things done in a way that may not necessarily please everyone and may lead to a couple of people jettisoning themselves overboard for a period of time, but eventually probably coming back. But, you know, resolving them to the satisfaction or to a point of satisfaction where the government kind of draws a line under something and moves on, and it's seen as settled or done business. And I think that's why this particular moment around climate and this particularly kind of difficult discussion that's going on is also so important. Because if they can get over to the other side, get to that point on climate, or at least on this particular part of climate policy, and prove that, you know, a lot of people may be pissed off, some people may even jump ship or lose the whip temporarily. No one's totally happy, but they are making progress. They are moving forward. They are, you know, making good that essential aspect of government, which is kind of trade-offs and bargains being achieved that kind of broadly speaking, keep the show on the road. I think that's why that is very important as well, and you know, generates its own kind of momentum. There's another important variable which they looked like they were going to have to face probably at some point in the like last quarter of this year, but now aren't going to have to face, which was the possibility that the Tánaiste could be facing criminal charges. With that going, that's something that could have proved massively destabilizing and probably was harder to plan for in a way than other kind of novel threshold issues like the changeover of the Taoiseach's position, just because it would be hard to predict exactly how his own parliamentary party, his own ministers and the partners in government would react to that, you know, exactly what the timelines would be if involved, if he faced charges, or, you know, if he'd just have to go on site if he was to be charged, which is the most likely. But that destabilizing potential is gone. And, you know, there's other areas in which the government is making progress. Obviously, COVID is kind of, from a kind of centre of the political discourse point of view, over and done with. You know, it's making progress on pension reform, although perhaps not as quickly as some people would like. The Defence Forces as well would seem to be something that it's going to make progress on in the budget. And I think that, you know, the support of Cathal Berry for the confidence vote in recent weeks shows that, you know, there's a constituency there that the policy is appealing to. So the long and the short of it is that, like, I think that there is plenty of grounds for encouragement that this government will go the full turn, not least because, as we often say on this podcast, governments don't tend to pull themselves down. And if a major cleavage doesn't emerge on climate policy, if they show that they have the capacity to motor on through climate policy and achieve things on that front, then I think that that's a major structural weakness that has been squared away, you know. But the proof of that will be in the pudding. You know, I think it depends, first of all, on getting this done, I would argue, this side of September. And then also, once those kind of abstract costs, and we've been criticised on this podcast before and the paper for framing climate as only kind of a costs issue as opposed to an opportunities one, but I think it's unavoidable that, like, there are going to be costs and changes that accrue to citizens. So once those costs crystallise and become tangible and real, the extent to which they can actually grapple with those and make policy around them will be the next challenge. But yeah, I think that, you know, I think there's a reasonable chance, not least because Sinn Féin are still riding high in the polls. So, you know, why would they pull themselves down if there's no polling evidence to suggest that, you know, they're going to do anything other than avoid Sinn Féin leading the next government?
And a last question to you, Patton, briefly, if you wouldn't mind. The people who you talk to on Merrion Street and Stephen's Green, Department of Foreign Affairs, Department of the Taoiseach, how much are they looking forward to a Liz Truss prime ministership?
Not very much, Hugh. It looks, as of now, that Liz Truss will be the next prime minister. I spoke to somebody at the very beginning of this process and asked them about the various contenders. This was long before they were whittled down to two contenders that they are now. And the view in Dublin at that stage was very much anybody but Liz Truss. Now, you might say that there was a few other buttes in the that briefly threw their hat in the ring that might have been worse than Liz Truss. But certainly, I think there's no doubt that Dublin would prefer Rishi Sunak, even though he hasn't said an awful lot about the protocol in the course of this campaign or beforehand, and will certainly, if he is asked about it, have to hew to the hard line that that all contenders have had to in recent weeks. But the view is that he might be more pragmatic than Liz Truss, who will be if she wins, and that's what the polls tend to suggest at the moment. Though, you know, I think I wouldn't be amazed to see that race tighten considerably, even if it doesn't turn around. But Liz Truss has been very much identified with the Northern Ireland Protocol legislation. She's been backed by not just the Downing Street establishment at the moment, but by the hardline ERG Eurosceptic wing of the Tory party. And the view is that she would pursue the current hardline of the British government, culminating in inevitably a conflict with the EU that could throw up all sorts of difficulties for the North and for the government in Dublin. So, I think Dublin is looking on with some trepidation at the course of that election at the moment.
something else to look forward to in the weeks and months ahead. But we'll leave that for today. Thanks very much to Pat, to Jen, and to Jack. Thanks to our producer, Declan Conlon. JJ Vernon is our engineer. We will be back very soon. You can contact us with your views, your questions, or your opinions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, goodbye, and thanks very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.